History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there, right there around you, that should not go untold. And what we've learned is they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take a little time to ask a few questions, and maybe more importantly, be patient enough to listen to what comes back our way. And when we visit with these World War II veterans, the story's not always the same. It's not always going overseas and being in a foxhole or getting shot down or being a prisoner of war. There are so many ways that so many Americans contributed that it's important that we remember. So we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm in Las Vegas, Nevada. Well, actually Henderson, Nevada, with 94-year-old, soon to be 95-year-old, Lester Burgwart Jr. But you didn't grow up around Henderson, Nevada, a very different climate. Tell me where you spent your early years.
Oh, I was born and raised in Hamburg, New York. It's just a little cow town south of Buffalo on a farm, dairy farm. So I've had the experience of milking cows and cleaning out the barn. That was my after school activity. I think some sophisticated people call that the extracurricular activities. Mine was half of the barn. My brother got the other half, the smaller half, to clean. Anyway, when I found out about World War II, was milking cows. There is quite a time differential between Honolulu and Hamburg, New York. Anyway, it was that was a Sunday afternoon, and it didn't mean much to me because, oh, Hawaiian Islands, my goodness, that was something in the movies. And as such, I let it roll off. It wasn't until I went to school Monday morning that, wow, everyone was excited. The seniors were discussing where they were going to go, whether it was Army or Navy, Marines. And it was still a mystery to me as a dumb farm kid.
And you would have only been 15 at the time.
That would be right. Yeah. I think if my math is somewhere near correct. So, gee, well, maybe anyway. As time went by and graduation came closer, yes, the Navy was my pick. I wasn't about to be drafted and so forth. So, like my fellow classmates, the males, we joined some service, and I joined the Navy. The Navy offered the V-5, V-12 program, which were college programs. Somehow or other, I passed the entrance exam for that program. I wound up in Swarthmore College. Now, not to be confused with Skidmore. You chuckled on that one, Skidmore being a female college.
Yeah, that would have been a tough one to get into.
So anyway, yeah, I did wind up in Swarthmore, mostly gals there, plus a group of Chinese officers who were learning English and the American way, and young fellas such as myself. Well, that was quite a jump from high school to collegiate, and particularly Swarthmore. It wasn't what I signed up for. I wanted the Navy. Well, little did I know that that was the entrance to the commission. I blew it and asked for a transfer before I flunked out.
And I want to circle back to that with you and hear that whole story. But I'm also curious because some of the people who are listening to this are young people, and their life today is a little bit different from your life as a young boy growing up in upstate New York. So I'd love to give them some perspective on what life was like as a boy growing up on a dairy farm where it snows for several months at winter. What did you like and what did you not like about that situation?
Oh, gee, riding your bike on an icy street 2 miles into town. Now, this is secondary. Elementary school was done in a little four room, very nice school building, and it was just through the woods. And there it was, maybe a quarter of a mile as a crow flies. But then to graduate from elementary school to go into high school, wow, that was quite a jump for a country boy.
And how big was Hamburg? What do you think the population was?
Well, at that time, on Friday night, when everyone's came in for supplies and what have you, movie theater and what, maybe 4,500. As I said, our place was 2 miles out of town. So across the street was the fairgrounds. The nearest neighbor of my age would be a quarter of a mile.
The cows were your neighbors.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we had a sheep or two. Those lambs, for some reason or other, would choose to be born on the coldest or wettest night of the year. And so they would be kept warm behind the kitchen stove. That may seem kind of crude to folks who have never had a wood stove. Your mother cooked on electric or gas if you were in town. But we had wood-fired kitchen stove, and it was nice and warm. It was a good place. And the chickens that were hatched in the cold were warmed in back of that kitchen stove, just as the lambs were kept warm on their first few nights. It was different, and everyone knew that down the street was that family, and they were great neighbors. And likewise in the other direction, on the other side of the woods were the kids I went to elementary school with, farm kids. However, our little town of Armour, which was a crossroads out of Hamburg, was a cross-section of factory workers who worked in Buffalo for the plant, the cereal, the grain, the shipping, and when the Depression hit, it was horrible. We were fortunate. We had pork from our own pigs, beef from our own beef, and chickens. That was a standard Sunday dinner. No turkeys, no ducks, no geese, but it was a farm life. Gee, we went fishing in the little stream that went through our pasture. It was great. I hated it when I was a kid. I did not appreciate what is happening. And honest to gosh, it would be so marvelous for these kids on the street corners with nothing to do but play marbles, if they had marbles.
A couple things I'm wondering. First of all, how old were you when you had to start milking cows?
Oh, good gracious. 7 or 8 at the most. And that's when I would squirt the milk to the cats who would line up in back of the cow waiting to be hit with a stream of warm milk. So, yeah, I had real good forearm development, believe me.
I bet you did. And you also mentioned that during the Depression, the folks from the neighboring town who worked in Buffalo at the factory, those jobs disappeared. So you saw how this was affecting other families, but it didn't affect your family as much? Was that what you were saying?
All my neighbors were on WPA, which was a government program. If you were the breadwinner for the family, you got X number of dollars per month, depending upon the number of kids you had to feed. Wood would be delivered, keep your house warm, to feed the cook stove. Flour would be dropped off, and there were WPA workers who would go from door to door dropping these supplies off. If you were a cigarette smoker, guess what? You got little bags of tobacco and the papers to roll your own cigarette. Oh, gosh, looking back, it would be hysterical for a number of people to take a look at that. But in retrospect, it was a hell of a good time.
It kind of sounds like it brought people together in their shared struggle.
Right. My dad turned up sick with pneumonia one winter. And you know, those cows never missed the milking on time. Why? Because the neighbors came in and did the chores. It was wonderful. In school, the WPA kids would have hot lunch served, if nothing more than a bowl of tomato soup that would frequently be curdled because they were not cooks. They were ladies who had nothing else to do. Anyway, you may know of what curdled tomato soup looks like. Well, I watched them eating that stuff while I had beautiful beef sandwiches. I trade those beef sandwiches with homemade bread for an onion sandwich with bakery bread. Oh, bakery bread was fantastic. But that was one of the things the WPA trucks would drop off.
And do you remember, as a boy, having a thought in your mind, an ambition, a dream? Hey, someday this is what I'm going to become. This is what I want to do for a living. This is who I want to be.
Yes. I had a mentor and a cousin who was fantastic student. He went to Rensselaer as a prep school for his West Point tests, and he made it to West Point, and that was a huge event. The Grays in their uniform. No, I couldn't. I was too young to go along with my folks, but they did that big trip from Hamburg to West Point, and they had blankets and lunches and so for extra water, you name it. But that was quite an event for them. And I wanted to do what he did. He became an officer in the Army. I thought that was pretty terrific. But I didn't figure I was ever going to be mentally capable of doing what he did. He retired as some sort of a general. He was my mentor.
What was his name?
Richard Meyer. But he was my inspiration to go ahead and do the collegiate some way or other, which the GI Bill was the route I was given. And that was, in my estimation, one of the finest public laws that I've seen in my lifespan. That did more good for more people and for the country. A tremendous number of gentlemen, and by that time, women who would not have had an opportunity to go to college had that opportunity along with their military service. True, it was a very expensive way to get an education. Some made it and some did not. And by that I mean the heroes are out there in the cemeteries, the real heroes. And I guess I reaped many of the benefits as a result of their sacrifices.
Well, and haven't we all? That's what this program is all about. We're going to find out just how far the GI Bill took Lester Burgwardt when we come back. But before he could take advantage of that, there was the matter of his World War II service in the Navy and a non-combat injury that would affect him for the rest of his life. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Mr. Burgwardt, and we'll be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 94-year-old Lester Burgwardt of Henderson, Nevada, originally from Hamburg, New York, where the Erie County Fair is held every August. It's the second largest fair in New York and the fourth largest county fair in North America. It dates back over 200 years now. And I understand those 266 acres of the fairgrounds are actually really close to where you grew up. And I guess the fairgrounds there even gave rise to your entrepreneurial spirit long before you enlisted in the Navy in World War II?
Oh, that was directly across the street from my folks' farm Yeah, that was quite an opportunity. It so happened that my folks had very good relationship with the operator of the racetrack. The races would go on for 70 days every summer. And that was a little special thing that happened in New York State. I had the first program station inside the main gate, and I got so much, I don't know, maybe a nickel for every program I sold for 25 cents.
Uh-huh.
That was big money. Golly, between that and selling newspapers before school to the stables, and then I bustered some neighbor kids to sell the newspaper in the evening in the grandstand. Altogether, maybe I could make $1,100, $1,200 in the summer, and that was as much or more than some of the superintendents for the factories that were still working. It was big money.
Yeah.
And that was part of the joy of living where I was, because there were no other teenagers my age and my position who were able to take advantage of that fairgrounds.
And so you started to tell me about when you joined the V5 program, but was there a reason that you were set on the Navy and that you wanted to avoid being drafted into the Army? Was there something that crystallized in your mind that made that decision for you?
Hey, I had all of the woodsy activity that I wanted. I sloshed in snow and mud and so forth. That was the picture I had of the Army. The Army Air Corps, that was beyond my mental capability. At least that's the way I figured. I didn't have the reach to get that. I chose the Navy. I'm glad I did. I never had to crawl through mud. I also had a clean bed to sleep in, which were two things that the Army had that I didn't want.
And you told us you're at Swarthmore, and it's a little challenging for you, and you weren't thinking that this is the path to being an officer necessarily. You just thought this wasn't for me, so you asked them to transfer you out so you wouldn't flunk out. Is that how you said it?
That's essentially it. My folks were not college people. Yes, I said my cousin was a mentor. Yes, but not at arm's reach. He was not there, but only on rare occasions. But I had him up on a pedestal, and I figured, gee, this dumb farm kid would never be able to reach that. The school I attended was great. I had a choice, I mean an opportunity, to have my biology teacher or my chemistry teacher to teach physics. My chemistry teacher, I swear, just overlooked us dumb farm kids. He was more in tune with the kids in town. The biology teacher, he talked my language. We got along great. But when it came to class assignments, I wound up getting the chemistry teacher. I walked into that class, and oh my gosh, I'm going to have a year with that guy? No way. And I walked out and went into the principal's office and said, Mr. Leader, and that was his name, please transfer me out of that physics class, and I'll take general shop as my elective. And that was the best move I'd ever made, because that gave me a chance to work with real woodworking equipment. I learned to solder and do electrical circuits and so forth, things I did not have the opportunity to experience or learn on the farm. Yes, I dropped physics, but since then I've taken summer school, a summer of physics in Seattle and another summer in Berkeley. So I've had my fill of physics. However, that did not help me in that physics class at Swarthmore. And I knew I wasn't going to cut it, that I was going to flunk it. So I bailed out and went to the active Navy before they bumped me. Does that make sense?
It does, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but the folks who keep hearing you refer to yourself as a dumb farm kid may be surprised to know that you've earned a doctoral degree, and maybe we'll get to that story before we're done. So you go out of this V5 program, which was putting young men who had enlisted in the armed forces in college to work academically before they would serve on active duty and earn a commission. You transfer out of that, and what did the Navy do with you? Where did they send you?
Well, I was in school in a learning situation, and I mean a formal education, virtually my entire 3 years. It was in just the last 6 months of my experience with the torpedo bomber squadron that I could see, oh my goodness, active duty is coming up. And this is when it was, will we or will we not have to invade the homeland islands?
Before we get to that, tell me about the process. When you left Swarthmore, where did you go next?
Then I went into boot camp. They selected individuals in from boot camp to go to various schools. I said I wanted to go to Aviation Machinist Mate School. They sent me to Norman, Oklahoma. That's just across the runway from University of Oklahoma.
So what kinds of things did you learn?
How to work the time in an aircraft engine, how to change parts, how to safety wire, how to run up an aircraft to check it out pre-flight. It was a great school. For a teenager, wow, that couldn't have been better. But from that group of people, the Navy selected those of my stature to go into aerial gunnery school, which I had the privilege, if you want to call it that, of doing that down in Miami. So I wound up as a turret gunner on a T, that's T as in Tom, B as in Baker, M, torpedo bomber. I faced backwards. I had a radioman down below and the pilot up front. Well, anyway, that's where I spent my last few months in the Navy, was in the operational training unit. We were preparing to go into the homeland islands.
And what is it like to fly in one of those TBM Avengers when you can't see where you're going and you're facing backwards?
Ah, that's fantastic. For a 17, 18-year-old, it couldn't have been better. It was great. 300 miles an hour at a 45-degree glide. What a thrill. Yeah, there are a few people who were injured and so forth, but I enjoyed it. Yes, I did. At the very end, one of the last flights I made, I had to fly with a pilot who was in remedial training. Let's call it that way. He was having difficulty in dropping bombs where they were supposed to be. Long story short, in a glide bomb, in a bombing run, the bombardier, which I was flying as that day, would call out the elevation from 10,000 feet down to 5,000 and give the pilot the word to pull out in case he was busy doing other things. Instead of this pilot continuing his glide, when he saw he was overshooting, he pushed forward on the stick, which caused the aircraft to develop negative Gs. And you don't fly an aircraft pulling negative Gs. He realized he was in error and pulled back on the stick. So everything that was up there on the overhead, the ceiling, everything that was loose met the aircraft coming back up to it. And I was unfortunate enough to be one of those objects. I wound up having compression fractures in 5 vertebrae, my lumbar. My entire lumbar region was sort of messed up. And being a big, brave guy, I picked up my chute out of the aircraft and went on to my evening meal. I never checked in with the medics because had I been run over to the hospital, I would have missed getting out of the Navy. This happened in January, and I was slated to get out in May. For some dumb reason, I was bent on getting out, which was, well, it was a dumb move on my part. I should have checked in and had the medics work me over and see what was wrong.
Let me ask a few questions about this. So you'd been doing this for a while. This was not your first practice flight in one of those TBMs.
My pilot got bumped because he and a couple other pilots decided that they would do a loop. The TBM was not designed for that kind of activity. And when this skipper found out about it, for some reason or other, those three pilots, including my pilot, were bumped from the squadron. Well, anyway, I wound up in this pilot aircrew pool where we had to fly these misfits.
I want to dig down on this because I want to understand the timing. So you had gone in 43, you're in the V5 program, then you go to aviation machinist mate school, you go to aerial gunnery school, and I'm sure in that they probably had you shooting at sleeves that are being tugged from other planes or shooting at moving targets, right?
Right.
Learning how to lead whatever your target is and all of that. So you've been through all of this, and I'm sure you're thinking, hey, I'm going to be going overseas and shooting at the Japanese, right?
Yeah.
That was your expectation.
Yes, indeed.
And you were on track to do that until your pilot and two other pilots broke the rules. And where was that? Where were you when that happened?
We were at Barbers Point, Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
Just out of Honolulu.
So that's the next step to being in a combat theater. You're halfway there.
Oh, yeah. We were eager to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was an expert on that machine gun with that turret. I'm a sharpshooter with that machine gun. But we're raring to go ahead trying our skills. I mean, here, we've been trained all along, and there it is. What's going to happen? Well, the bomb was dropped, or the bombs were dropped. And although President Truman, and this is politics, has been criticized by many people for dropping those bombs or authorizing that, it saved so many lives. Had we had to go into the homeland islands of Japan, it would have been a horrible situation.
And
but hey, we were ready to do it.
And when the time that you spent stationed in Hawaii, had you seen Pearl Harbor? Could you still see some of the indications of what had happened there?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Nevada, the battleship Nevada, was put aground deliberately to keep it from sinking in the channel. And it's a landmark over there. This is Nevada Point. This is where the battleship Nevada was grounded deliberately. Okay? There was one ship that was still over on its side. I'd never seen the bottom of a battleship, but it's round. So anyway.
So you saw all that.
Yeah,
when
it was
you got
there.
And you guys are doing exercises from Naval Air Station, Barbers Point.
Yeah.
Practicing to go overseas. And if you had been part of that, you would have been flying those glide bombing missions against heavily defended areas where you're not just firing your machine guns, they're firing at you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right.
How did you feel about that possibility?
You know, I don't think I had no thoughts about that. And I'm certain most of the men I was with. Hey, we were the best shots. We were going to survive. We were going to be the winners. No question about it. We were infallible. We couldn't be touched.
And so explain to me what it was that happened there at Barbers Point that stopped you from being deployed overseas. You guys were just up on a routine patrol or training mission when your pilots pulled that trick?
I was looking down at the ground.
Did you know he was going to do that?
Yes and no. His two buddies had done that and said, okay, Stu, when are we going to do that? Well, we were all kind of by ourselves that day. All of a sudden, he started down picking up speed. And oh, my goodness. That's what the Earth looks like. Upside down. Yeah, the aircraft did a good job. True, the wings did get a few little bumps in it when they flexed. But, hey, that was 18-year-old riding there. Troubles will only happen to other people, never to us. This is the philosophy or the outlook, the mental, yeah.
What does that do to your stomach?
Hell, it's no trouble at all. This is great.
But so then you bring that TBM back in, and somebody says, Shame on you. You guys weren't supposed to do that, and you're out of here? Or how did that go?
Well, we were not privy to the discussion between the skipper and those pilots, but I can well imagine what the heck happened, okay? First of all, we had a Marine Corps major as our squadron commander.
And what, that was VC-14, is that what you said?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Which was not unusual, but my pilot was a Mustang. He started out as an enlisted man and became a major in the Marine Corps. And I guess that does not set too well with the commissioned officers who have done the bookwork and received a direct commission. So anyway, I can imagine our CO commander read the riot act to those three guys. It was never discussed, but as I say, all of this, and now we get bumped.
Those three pilots and their crews are dismissed from the squadron. What did the squadron do? Where did the squadron go?
The squadron went on aboard carrier and were standing off the Japanese islands, ready to do their thing.
Did they leave you in Hawaii, or did they send
you?
Yeah, left you in Hawaii. And so then you become crews for pilots who had had trouble, who were trying to earn their stripes still and prove they can handle it. And that's when you end up on this flight where you were injured.
Yes.
I want to make sure we better understand that situation and the ramifications, but it's break time again. Lester Bergwart of Henderson, Nevada is our guest today. He'll turn 95 just before Memorial Day. He spent nearly 30 years in uniform of one kind or another, and he spent the last 75 years dealing with the effects of that injury suffered in his TBM Avenger. It hasn't stopped him from a life of service and significance, and we'll learn more about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today in Henderson, Nevada with Lester Bergwart, 94-year-old veteran of World War II who was also in uniform during the Korean and Vietnam War eras. I want to thank Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting me to Mr. Bergwart, or Dr. Bergwart if we account for all the educational achievements this self-described dumb farm kid from Western New York has piled up. We'll hear about his honor flight experience in a bit, but first I want to fully understand a much different flight. Back when he was 19 years old, in the aft end of a TBM Avenger, a flight that left him with compression fractures and 5 vertebrae in his lumbar region. That TBM was practicing a glide bomb run.
You're counting down the elevation, the altitude, and he realizes that he's going to overshoot the target, so his adjustment is to push down on the stick to put it into a steeper dive.
You got it.
And but you're sitting
back on target.
Right. But he's changing the angle.
Yeah.
You're like on one of those roller coasters that drop straight down, but you're facing backwards.
I'll be doggone. That's a good, yeah.
Okay. So what are you experiencing in the back of that plane? Help me understand it from your perspective.
Well, when I wound up hitting the sheet, coming down on that sheet, it took my breath away. And I thought, oh my God, you've got a farmer's back at age 18 in the back of this aircraft. You'll be walking around stooped, such as a couple of my uncles were.
Because when he put it into that steeper dive, your body floats up to the canopy, to the lid.
Yep.
And then when he straightened it back out, you get slammed back into the seat.
Well, the aircraft comes up and hits you.
Uh-huh.
Yes. You're slapped down. Everything that's loose, everything that was up above the overhead comes down or meets the aircraft. I was just one of the free-floating bodies.
So you know now that impact compressed your spine and injured you pretty badly, but at the time, you just thought you could tough it out and you'd be okay?
Oh, yeah. My uncles walked around. My dad walked around.
So what happened after that?
Well, I was discharged.
Because you only had a few more months to go.
Yeah.
So you didn't receive a medical discharge because you didn't say anything, but you finished out your enlistment.
Right. Nobody asked me about injuries. I wasn't bleeding. It was an injury that you couldn't see unless you understood the tender back.
And how bad was it? How did that affect you after that?
As long as I didn't act my age, no problem. I had to be careful how I moved. I knew what would cause pain. If I moved improperly, my legs could go out from under me. But I didn't demonstrate that because I said, wait a minute. If I do have this injury, the military will not take me back. So I never pushed it. I didn't demonstrate that while I was in the National Guard. I didn't demonstrate that while I was in Army Reserve. And in 2005, I finally received the court order saying that, yes, that is a service-connected injury, and I was awarded 100% disability. Here I am. I can't walk unassisted. Anyway, what more is there?
I'm curious. So those people that you went to school with in Hamburg, you mentioned that after Pearl Harbor, the seniors were signing up, and you saw things change there in your small hometown. Were there any of your friends, people you knew in high school or in the Navy, who were killed during World War II?
Oh, yes. Our valedictorian died on the beaches of Salerno. Another one, Pete, wound up on one of the Pacific Islands. He came in, slammed his desk top down after he extracted his books, bid the homeroom teacher a fond farewell. He said, I'm going to join the Marines. He did, and I guess he got out of boot camp and was in one of the invasion armies, and he was killed. My dear buddy, Ed, went with the Army and was killed in flight school. He managed to wreck one of the Army's trainers and killed himself.
Well, and I ask that because I think that helps us digest it. Those who weren't alive then, we don't have a concept of how this touched everyone. So here's your small town and your school, and you just listed three boys who knows what their futures could have been had they come home from the war, and they didn't get to. And I know when you went to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada, you got to see where those three and the other 406,000 Americans who died in World War II are honored. But I also recognize in your story that this affected you for the rest of your life. You're a 19-year-old kid who suffers this injury in the back of that TBM Avenger, and physically, you've never been the same, right?
That's exactly right. Now, I was bent on having a nursery, a commercial nursery, and I gave that up because I could not have handled the work of a nursery. And when I got out of the Navy after having been recalled for the Korean War, I decided I'm going to get a backup occupation. I went to Greeley, Colorado. I was sent to the dean of the graduate school. And he said, I tell you, Les, we can have you out of here a year from now with a teaching certificate and your master's degree. Oh, let's go for that. Because I still had GI Bill. The job that was offered was here in Henderson, Nevada, and I've been here ever since.
How long did you teach?
30 years.
What'd you teach?
Biology and geology. Because I was an outdoorsman and needed a summer job, well, I was offered a summer job as day camp leader for the city of Las Vegas. Oh, yeah, I think what precipitated that was the fact that I believe most of our teachers at that time were from someplace else other than the desert. And so I had an in-service classes that would take the teacher on weekends from the dam, Lake Mead, its role in the Southwest. We even went to the dump because at that time, lo and behold, we were burning all of the refuse and there would be a huge black cloud going up over Sunrise Mountain.
So you would take the teachers out to Hoover Dam?
Yes, through the dam.
Uh-huh. Give them a guided tour. Explain how it all works and all of that.
Yeah, right from the bottom up to the very top.
And then you started doing that with school children.
For the kids. And we'd wind up in the Spring Mountains. And you know, there are vanilla pine trees up there and chocolate pine trees, as well as sarsaparilla.
Uh-huh.
And if you go up to the pines and just peel off a little bit of the bark and quickly smell it, you can distinct odor of vanilla, chocolate, or sarsaparilla. But they would be going up there looking for these fossils. Fossils that were washed out of Kyle Canyon down with the rains over the years. And I would bet the kids that I could take and the silver dollars were common at that time. I'd say, I'll bet you the silver dollar, I can throw it out there, and within arm's reach, I'll pick up a fossil. I never lost a dime. And then, yes, I did become a guide, a dam guide at Hoover Dam in the summers and on busy weekends, like at Christmas, New Year's, they need extra guides. And so I do that one. Never been without a job.
So what was your doctorate in?
Science education, biological sciences.
And during the Korean War, when you got recalled, what did the Navy have you doing?
Oh, gracious. Again, this is not a characteristic or classic hero story. When it was discovered that I had a degree in horticulture, Naval Air Station, Sandpoint, Seattle, grabbed me and said, hey, the skipper's just fired the groundskeeper. How would you like that job? Bingo. Absolutely. Because that used to be the most beautiful, beautiful naval station I had ever been in. Hedges trimmed and well manicured. Golf course, rose garden. Give me a shot. And I was given, 8-10 sailors. And we went to work. It was a much different looking place when we left there.
So between when you enlisted in World War II and the end of the Korean War, that's 10 years that you had either been active duty or reserve. And then you come here to Henderson, you're teaching, you start that day camp, you're doing all of that. And then during the Vietnam War, when a lot of people are trying to get out of serving, you decided that you wanted to be a part of our military again?
I was no longer in the reserve. Many of my students wound up going to Vietnam.
What did you do for the National Guard and the Army Reserve in the 60s, 70s, and 80s? What did they have you doing?
When the personnel officers looked at my academic record, he said, "You don't want to be a machinist. You're a biologist." I said, "Well, I guess you're right." He said, "Let's make you a medic. Will you accept that?" "Yes, that'd be real fine. I'd love that." And so I was the medical instructor for the new recruits coming into the National Guard or the Army Reserve who wanted to be medics. It was like just having a Saturday and Sunday class. We did real well. So, yes, I do meet a few. There are a few of those people around.
And I don't want to get the wrong idea, but am I correct in understanding that these medics that you're instructing, that you're training, these are guys who would, in some cases, then deploy to Vietnam and are saving lives over there?
Oh, heck yes. No, our local National Guard has done it, and Reserve has done a good job in filling the ranks in Vietnam, as they did in Korea, and as they did in the Mediterranean.
And for you, even though you didn't see combat in World War II, during the Korean War, or during the Vietnam War, you were part of that effort in all three of those wars, supporting what was happening. What kind of pride or satisfaction do you take in those contributions?
Well, I'm glad to have done my duty and served my country. I know there are people who may cuss the military, but hey, we've got some very fine people who are the grunts of the military, and my hand is off to them. Not everyone can be a general. Not everyone can be a colonel. A lot of girls and boys wind up being soldiers. And, well, I guess one of the things the Army Reserve stresses is that we are soldiers for life. You've heard that motto, I'm certain.
And you've lived it.
And I feel, without half trying, I have been doing that.
And a few years ago, you got to fly to Washington, D.C. with a couple dozen other veterans and Honor Flight Southern Nevada to visit the National World War II Memorial and the Korean War Memorial and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall and other
and
spots.
And Lincoln and so on, you bet.
Yeah. Tell me about that. What was it like for you?
Oh, that was actually, if you can imagine a bunch of older military people who have to clear their throat, maybe even wipe a tear or so, it was a warming experience to walk down the corridor in Baltimore Airport and see the people in that airport just parting the way for this group of old dogs coming through. It was a heartwarming experience, and I can only thank the people who have been the sponsors of the Honor Flight program for doing their part and make me clear my throat when I think of it. I've heard people fussing about, oh, I was never recognized when I came home. No, good gracious, there was no parade in my hometown. I don't know if my dad said hi or not, but there was a pitchfork in the manure pile, and he was hauling out. Back east, you collect that manure during the winter, okay, when you can't put the cows out. Well, he was clearing that, and that was my welcome home, son.
Get back to work in the manure pile?
So that Honor Flight served a real purpose there. It was like welcome home.
A whole lot better than a manure pile.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your service. I have the feeling that your destination is not written out and predetermined. I feel that you have a responsibility to make that life legacy what you make of it, mm-hmm. that you can really influence.
I guess the follow-up would be, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, soldier for life, because I love this country, and a teacher forever. If those kids I've had over the years, if those contacts I've had over the years have learned anything, and if I have helped them enjoy their teenage or their golden years, beautiful. What more can a person expect? One thing I would like to leave with every veteran listening to your program, keep your records. Keep your records. No, there is no useless record. It's amazing. I've gone through a couple of cases where that record, that one record, that piece of 8-inch by 4-inch paper that says, in my belief, this could only have happened as the patient describes.
Lester Bergwart, 94 years old. Don't forget to find photos and a short video with him online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.